All right, August 18th, 2023. Star date. Hello, everybody. As I mentioned, I am in Philadelphia on a teaching and family visit trip. Today was more in the family visit part. Tomorrow will be the teaching part. So it's a nice balance. And teaching, well, everything's good with my family. And my parents aren't alive, so I don't have to deal with that. Because then it would be like, teaching would be like an escape from that. Much as I love my parents. My brother pulled out this slide projector the other night. And started, and I had slides from like 1958, there's one where I'm in a red robe, apparently preparing for confirmation, sitting with my mother. I mean, whew, just hairy, very hairy. But that's all behind us, and thank God for Buddhism that suggests that we just like get over it. That's not really what Buddhism says, so don't listen to that. We'll start with some sitting. Looks like maybe people have ceased arriving, so we can settle in. Not sure how my own energy will hold up. If I start falling asleep during the meditation, don't take it personally. And don't judge me, please. It's 10 o'clock at night here. That's late for meditating. It's a good time to be like watching television, but all right. I will cease rambling. So just settling into your meditation posture. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And tuning into how you're holding your body, the balance, trying to find a posture that allows you to remain still and also be relatively comfortable. Feeling the body breathing. Aware of your own environment, whatever sounds are present. And feeling the weight of the body, having a sense of just softening and releasing. It's kind of gradual inhabiting of the body as we tune in. Softening the belly, Just bringing a quality of ease. And then letting the breath become your primary focus, letting that come into the foreground. Feeling the sensations at the nostrils or the movement of the belly. And this is a very natural thing to pay attention to the breath. Not that we're trying to obscure other aspects of our experience, just feeling this, feeling the body breathing. The natural settling that happens with that. When the mind wanders, when you find yourself lost, just acknowledge that and gently come back. The key is to be gentle. Trusting mindfulness no need to force anything with mindfulness, there is a gradual and increasing attunement to our inner state, particularly the pre-verbal or non-verbal aspect of our inner life. and the cues from this felt sense let us know if we are in a state of grasping or aversion, or if we are calm or settled, accepting. You become familiar with the feeling of being present, mindful, so that when there's some agitation or aversion, set off inner alarms. Something is out of balance, and we can come back, reset. Connect with the breath. Okay, I'm gonna go run my get my Bhikkhu Bodhi book. I'll be right back. Figure out what I was going to talk about, and then when we were meditating, I was like, oh, that thing I was just reading. I'm teaching a day long tomorrow that is really meant to be about sila, samadhi, and panya, but like, actually, it's actually what you call it? It's being. It'll be streamed, so you can come. It's gonna be what you call it? I'm very tired. It's a hybrid event, and so here's the website of the that it's the first event on that page, and I was trying to put the words. For Sila Samadhi Panya into like English, and it wound up being Buddhist Ethics, Mindfulness, and Insight for Recovery, which is just really not a great title. That's what happens when people ask me for a title six months in advance. But anyway, I wanted to read a little bit Bhikkhu Bodhi. Frames this topic, and this is from this, of course, book, The Noble Eightfold Path, and this is under Right View, which is the first of the Eightfold Path, so he sort of does an introduction. He says, considered from the standpoint of practical training, the eight path factors divide into three groups, the moral discipline group, sila khanda, made up of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. The concentration group, which what I could call the meditation group. Samadhi khanda, made up of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And the wisdom group, panya khanda, made up of right view and right intention. These three groups represent three stages of training, the training in the higher moral discipline, the training in the higher consciousness, and the training in the higher wisdom. The order of these trainings is determined by the overall aim and direction of the path. So here you go. Now we get flipped. Watch this. Since the final goal to which the path leads, liberation from suffering, depends ultimately on uprooting ignorance, the climax of the path must be the training directly opposed to ignorance. This is the training in wisdom, designed to awaken the faculty of penetrative understanding which sees things as they are, quote unquote. Wisdom unfolds by degrees, but even the faintest flashes of insight presuppose as their basis a mind that has been concentrated, cleared of disturbance and distraction. Concentration is achieved through the training in the higher consciousness, the second division of the path, which brings the calm and collectedness needed to develop wisdom. So what he's doing, he's going backwards, he's going panya, samadhi, sila. But in order for the mind to be unified in concentration, a check must be played on the unwholesome dispositions which ordinarily dominate its workings, since these dispositions disperse the beam of attention and scatter it among a multitude of concerns. I'm going to come back to that sentence. The unwholesome dispositions continue to rule as long as they are permitted to gain expression through the channels of body and speech as bodily and verbal deeds. Therefore, at the very outset of training, it is necessary to restrain the faculties of action to prevent them from becoming tools of the defilements. This task is accomplished by the first division of the path, the training in moral discipline. Thus, the path evolves through its three stages with moral discipline as the foundation for concentration, concentration the foundation for wisdom, and wisdom the direct instrument for reaching liberation. I mean, it's one of the more unusual approaches to explaining this, you know, by saying, well, we want to get to wisdom, that's enlightenment. But to get there, we've got to be concentrated. But to get concentrated, we've got to have ethical moral behavior. So we need to start with moral behavior. So instead of like starting by saying we need moral behavior to build, he works it backward, which is, you know, just sort of original. Well, he goes further here because, you know, here he's explained that the path really is sila samadhi panya. It starts with the morality, you know, and builds concentration and then wisdom. But then the first path factor in the way he's in this book and the way the Buddha usually talks about it is right view, which is a wisdom factor. So the question also often comes up, why, if the path is sila samadhi panya, does the Buddha start with panya? So here we go. Hold on to your seats. Perplexity sometimes arises over an apparent inconsistency in the arrangement of the path factors and the threefold training. Wisdom, which includes right view and right attention, is the last stage in the threefold training, yet its factors are placed at the beginning of the path rather than at the end, as might be expected according to the canon of strict consistency. I don't know what school Bhikkhu Bodhi went to, but I didn't learn to write like this. The sequence of the path factors, however, is not the result of a careless slip, but is determined by an important logical consideration, namely, that right view and right intention of a preliminary type are called for at the outset as the spur for entering the threefold training. Right view provides the perspective for practice, right intention the sense of direction. But the two do not expire in this preparatory rule, for when the mind has been refined by the training in moral discipline and concentration, it arrives at a superior right view and right intention, which now form the proper training in the higher wisdom. So it's a really interesting take and really interestingly explained that would, and I'll tell you, let me have a drink of water here. What he's saying, and how I would put it, is that before you're going to start to meditate at all, you're going to have some reason, you're going to have some degree of wisdom, of right view. Like, why would you sit down to do this whole thing of, like, sitting still doing nothing and having your mind, like, spin out half the time, trying to get somewhere, if you didn't think, like, I've got a problem, and meditation, as I understand it, could help me with it. The problem, of course, being dukkha, right? The problem being craving. Like, my mind, you know, I've got this agitation in my mind and my, you know, in my thoughts, my feeling, my emotional life. And as I understand it, meditation and mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom are meant to, you know, help me to deal with that. So I have that little bit of right view to get started, right? And then, as you said, and then you have to have, like, the motivation, which is the right intention. Now I've got to, like, actually put forth some effort to get started. And then, as he says, you know, ultimately, you know, so right view has this, as he says, preliminary form, but then when it's fulfilled, when you have, you know, complete right view, you have this awakening. So I always find this interesting, as I say, because the way the way the Eightfold Path, when the Buddha lists the Eightfold Path, he usually starts with right view, right intention. But the Sila Samadhi Panya model shows up more when he's giving a developmental Dharma talk. So developmental Dharma talks, a lot of them show up in the Digha Nikaya, the longer discourses. And in those discourses, the Buddha often is talking to lay people, and he'll start by talking about generosity, and then he'll talk about the precepts, and then he'll talk about the hindrances. And he might, when he talks about the precepts, he might talk about right speech and right livelihood. So he would be laying down all these elements of sila. And then, after he's talked about that and the hindrances, then he'll talk about concentration. But interestingly, I may have to go, I'm going to have to go back and look at some of these suttas, but they don't. Those suttas don't tend to lay out like the four foundations of mindfulness. They might reference mindfulness, mindfulness and clear comprehension. But yeah, so it's like one of the things that you come to realize is that over the centuries, and indeed in our own time, many teachers have kind of come to these suttas, as well as commentaries, and sort of put together what the Buddha was saying, and clarified what he was saying, because it's not always clear exactly what he means. Sometimes I think that it's almost, it's hard to tell exactly what was going on. Like, did the people at that time, did the monks, have enough background that they already sort of had a context for understanding what he was saying? Or were there. So was it. So, in other words, I would think of it as almost like he was speaking in a code that they knew already, or is it that it really did need to be explained, or did you need to hear all the different things and sort of put them together? It's hard to know, but certainly when I first came to the Dharma, and I suspect this is true for most of you, I read things that were like Joseph Goldstein or Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, and I mean, those are the sort of ones in my background, but and they had already done a lot of this filtering, a lot of sort of putting things together, and then they packaged it and presented it in these very easy to understand Western terms. But even they had already, like, received that through other people's voices, like particularly Munindra, who was Joseph's teacher, and then Ajahn Chah, who's Jack's teacher, and so that they weren't get they weren't. My sense is that they weren't reading suttas that much at in their early teaching, so they kind of were taking commentarial teachings and presenting them, and so the what I'd say, like, more modern Western Buddhism really started in 1995 when Bhikkhu Bodhi published the Majjhima Nikaya, and we were, for the first time, saw a whole collection of suttas, and we started to get a much broader picture of the early teachings. I want to say what the Buddha exactly what the Buddha taught, but we don't know that this is exactly what the Buddha taught, but certainly the earliest preserved teachings. And That, for many of us who had been around for a while, this kind of th it was like throwing the jigsaw puzzle up in the air for us. Like, oh, wait, like I thought I understood all this, and now I'm hearing the stuff that I don't understand. And then you would kind of go back and look at, okay, what was Joseph Goldstein referring to here? And you realize that he was referring to sutras or what he'd been taught about sutras, and then you started to kind of put, two and two together. And but it's almost been like a whole reconfiguration of understanding the Dharma for someone like me, who had been practicing for 15 years before that book came out, and for others who'd r been around for a long time. So then I get something like Bhikkhu Bodhi's, explanation, and it's kind of like, even though it's very dense in itself, it at least kind of resolves a lot of those kind of questions that showed up when I started to read the suttas. I don't know if that quite qualifies as a talk, but I was gonna talk about one other thing. Completely different topic. Because I am traveling and in all these different settings and circumstances, and in my own routines are disrupted, just really noticing how, in one sense, like how fragile at least my psyche can be. That I get very dependent on like routine. And I think, it helps, like as an alcohol, when I was actively drinking and using, I mean, I did that actually. It evolved into something very routine. But certainly in the early years, my life was really chaotic. And I think getting sober, I really wanted to like get rid of the chaos. And like one way to do that was like create routine. So then when I go out and I'm traveling like I am, and I'm, not in at home, not in my own bed, don't have my own schedule, all that gets thrown up, and it's an interesting, it's like a psychic test for me. Like, where am I at? Like, how am I handling this? Like on Monday, I flew on Thursday and arrived at the hotel after midnight Thursday. Drove on Friday to Omega, taught Friday, Saturday, Sunday. On Sunday afternoon, I drove 4 hours to Ithaca. And on Monday, I opened up my computer and it wasn't working. It was dead. And I was like, okay, this is good. This is practice right here. And it's interesting, I didn't freak out too much. I didn't really freak out, which surprises me in a way. But really seeing like that still, like, sleep is really important, right? Like food is really important, and exercise is really important. And when you have your routine, you have that all under control. And when you lose control of it, across the Pennsylvania line, and immediately I start thinking about pretzels. Some of you know that I have a little pretzel problem. It's like just all of that, and seeing how important it is to like take care of myself. And and I've been taken care of really well. Like I'm in Philadelphia. This woman's like, well, I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm just gonna give you my apartment, and I'll go stay with a friend. I'm like, okay, I guess that's okay. Like, I've got her like apartment. Like, and I'm like, wait a minute, is this right? Maybe I shouldn't be staying here. But the Dharma is, and recovery. I mean, they are refuges. I've been, because I always wind up talking, even if I'm not teaching, I'm talking about the Dharma. My niece is sober, so, and she came to Omega, and I'm staying with her, and
when I'm not in Philadelphia. I've been staying with her for a few days. And then her brother, I spent the afternoon with him and talking about his alcoholic parents and how he's handling them. That he, you know, and so, you know, our practice and our recovery, it's like when we let them become our lives, they have this natural way of just infiltrating everything in a really wonderful way. I had dinner with a bunch of people here in Philadelphia who like are, you know, where I'm going to be teaching, you know, people who are part of that community, and they had me for dinner, and, you know, and then it's more recovery and more Dharma, and it's like, oh, that's good. Right? It's, and we know, like, this community and this orientation, this refuge is so, so precious, and I really do feel protected in a lot of ways, and protected as Trungpa, you know, my nemesis, said, though, you know, when we get the protection cords around our wrist at the end of the retreat, someone said, what are we being protected from? Protected from ourselves, you know. And I do feel like I'm being protected from myself, because I, you know, the part of me that could, like, freak out because my computer broke, or because I didn't get enough sleep, or these people won't leave me alone. So, all right, I've filled up the airspace enough. I'll let you guys chime in here. It would be nice to hear from any or all of you. Oh, and look, Angela's doing her thing, putting everything in the chat. Thank you, Angela. Somebody say something, come on. Can't leave me here.
I'll say something. Hi, Kevin.
Oh, hi, Debbie. I'm gonna answer the question in the website. Yes, it is Eastern time, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Oh, that's good, it's only 10 to 4. Yeah, so 7 to 1, East Coast, West Coast, sorry. What's up? How you doing, Debbie?
I'm pretty good. I've had a big long day, and I've also missed this group for a little bit because of various circumstances, and it feels like a coming home. It feels really nice. Yeah. So it's nice to see everyone. You know, just what kind of came to my mind towards the end here as you were talking was, you know, how we are engage with our lives, and I just wrote down, you know, my lens is recovery and Dharma. You know, if I am looking through a lens, you know, or a filter or something, that is those two things, just like you said. I'm so grateful to have those, and yet sometimes I think, well, what about the clear still waters? You know, if I'm wearing a lens, how clearly am I seeing? and yet I look at it, this is from my perspective of how I want to approach my life. I want to stay clean, I want to stay sober. It's opened so many doors for me, and then the Dharma side of things just has offered so much freedom. Even it's offered me freedom from a label of, you know, sometimes I, you know, I don't like the label of being an alcoholic. And yet with the Buddhist practices, I can be free of labels and then just continue to open up to the next moment and see where I am. And the biggest thing is every morning I can wake up and be grateful for another day. I am an alcoholic, and that's okay. And let's just do the next right thing as much as I can. And then when I get caught up in all the minutia, just go, oh, I'm so human. It's okay.
Yeah.
And hopefully not go too deep, because once in a while things go deep, you know, deep in the dark side. But I just know there's always this. The Dharma is kind of like the rope, that I, you know, helps me kind of get pulled out. Dharma and recovery glasses, I'm grateful for both of those, and you are a huge part of that in my life. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Debbie. And I really like, actually, I'm glad you referred to like not having a lens too, because I think it's wise like to ask that question, because this is the typical kind of almost like a Mahayana question in a way, not necessarily, not to blame it on him, but that like, well, wait a minute, it's all empty, you know, what about labels? And the way I view that is that I use a lens when I need it, and much of the time I do need it. There are times when lenses fall away, right? There are times when everything is the clear pool, when, you know, especially on retreats and other spiritual moments, when it's just like, I don't even really like the word emptiness so much as, you know, interconnectedness and unafflicted, you know, and I don't need to go, oh, I'm an alcoholic, you know, I don't need to go, like, my only refuge is the Dharma, you know, and I need to talk to someone about this or whatever, and which is how, you know, 80%, 90%, a whole lot of my life is it. I need that lens because in ordinary mind states, you know, I have that. All that conditioning is there that has to be dealt with. But when the stillness arises and the conditioning falls away, then yeah, I'm not like, you know, insistent on like, yeah, but I'm still an alcoholic. It's like, no, you know, that's okay right now. That's not, that, you know, really the issue. Again, it's kind of that balance and being attuned and sensing, where am I right now? What do I need right now? Do I need, because as we know, like, there's a lot of relapse that happens with people who go like, oh, I don't need this anymore, or I'm not really an alcoholic. And it's like, well, where's that coming from? Is it a place of true freedom, or is it a place of subtle aversion, you know, and boredom or restlessness, you know, that's like, oh, well, I'm a Buddhist, you know, or even just a period of clarity, and saying, great, I'm in this state of clarity, I'm going to enjoy this, you know, but I'm not going to pretend that somehow I've permanently eliminated, you know, the obfuscations or the, you know, what are the words that... You know, I can't think of the terms, but you know that you always have these classic terms in the texts for you know, the greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, have I really overcome them? Okay, then I don't have to have any lenses anymore. It's a really good reflection. Thank you for that share.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, you too.
Hello.
Hi, Anne.
Hi. I just, you know, when you said you crossed the Pennsylvania state line and you had a craving for pretzels. That's just, you know, I don't know. I don't know if you meant because you're kind of going home in a sense, going to your home turf, and it's, you know.
Well, that just, I knew that now I could find some.
So now you can find some. It's very practical.
And I, you know, as soon as I pulled into a gas station, I was like, I wonder if they have any pretzels in here. And when I got to my niece's house, she had already like bought a bag of pretzels for me. But by then I had one of my own. So, you know, there you go.
You know, I just came back from a long road trip, and I spend a lot of time with family, my siblings, but also cousins and a dear uncle and a dear aunt and the grave sites of my great grandparents. You know, and I was going out to Minnesota to spend a week on the lake with my siblings, and I didn't know what to expect. We hadn't been together. And, you know, we had a very separate lives growing up, really, because the way we moved around the country so much, and there were 14 years difference between all the five kids and so forth and so on. And, you know, but the through line was this, for our family, was kind of like the alcoholic, you know, kind of scary place. You know, that was the through line, even though we came together a lot during holidays and stuff. But so it was just going to be the four of us and the sibling and the eight of us. I had no idea what to expect. And we're talking about Dharma and recovery and it being our lives and how it kind of beautifully weaves in. And, you know, what I noticed, nobody drank the entire week. And I never said anything and no one said anything. I just, at one point, I was like, wow, no one is drinking. We're on an island in the middle of this lake. It's not a very big lake, but, you know, the boat wasn't filled up with booze or
beer. Yeah.
It was amazing. And I got to teach Qigong every morning. My family. And we even did a meditation out loud circle one morning. There were a few of us up early and we just did this. My brother-in-law actually suggested we do this meditation out loud, what's coming up. Mm-hmm. And then we had a beautiful discussion with my brother, who's having some tough time with, you know, obsessive thinking and wow. I mean, it was, yeah, it's my life and I got to bring it into my family. And I never expected that outcome. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Things change if you get up. You're lucky enough to stick around and stay sober and do some work. You know.
Yeah.
I get to change and show up and see what happens.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. That's really, and it's a rare thing when family members start to come around. It's big. Yeah. There's a lot of sobriety in my family. And then some like not really caring about alcohol. And then there's a few, you know, alcoholics, like one brother, his wife, one niece, and most of the rest are really pretty good. And I don't have relationships with those people anymore. It's like, well, you know, it's okay. I think I'm gonna kick it, you know. For those who might have tuned in late, I'm on the East Coast and it's approaching 11 o'clock. And so I need to, and I'm getting up at the normal hour that people get up to teach a day-long retreat. And so I will attempt to get rest. I am planning on being on here on Tuesday. And I'll be back in Easton at my niece's place. And then next Friday, I'll be in Washington, D.C. And I don't know, this late night stuff isn't so great. So if one of you wonderful support staff and fellow teachers.
The 26th? Is that the 26th?
Could be.
I think I'm signed up for that.
Oh, you're signed up for that? Yeah. That would be excellent. Yeah, because I can do it, but, you know, I hate to say I don't enjoy it, but a little bit. I don't enjoy it as much, being tired. And I'm not cranky, but I'm tired. And I don't feel like I have much to give people, and they don't like to teach when I don't feel like I'm giving much. In any case, I showed up. So that's job number one, everybody. Okay. So really, really good to see everyone. I hope everybody's doing well. And, you know, I am going to teach a live
day long in Berkeley at the monastery in, I think it's like September 30th. Yeah, September 30th on the Anapanasati Sutta. So anybody in the Bay Area, I hope I'm putting it into my calendar now. I hope you'll come out because it'd be nice. And we'll make it, I think we'll be able to make it hybrid, but you know, if you're in the Bay Area or, you know, even, you know, people in Southern California probably should come up north to get away from the hurricane anyway. So I know that's, there might not be a hurricane still at the end of September, but you know, who knows? A hurricane in California is just wrong. So wrong. Why did we move to California? To get away from all this stuff. Plus to get away from our families. But anyway. All right, you guys. Yeah.
That was the 29th, Kevin?
I think it's the 30th.
30th, sorry.
September. It's way off. Miles away. That's a Saturday. Yeah. All right.
Thank you, Kevin.
Okay, you guys.
Good night, Kevin.
Good night, everyone. Thank you.